Welcome to the conference. We're very happy to see you here. This conference is being sponsored mainly by the Cognitive Rhythms Collaborative, which is a group of about 30 labs in the Boston area, all interested one way or another in brain rhythms from many different perspectives, ranging from producing new electrodes up to neurosurgery. But we're all interested in brain dynamics, and we've prepared what we think is a great lineup for you. Our other sponsors for this include the McGovern Institute, the Peekower Center, the Hariri Center, the Center for Computational Neuroscience and Neural Technology at BU, and the Martinos Imaging Center. So I'll have more logistical announcements for you later, but let's start with the program. And the chair of this morning's session is going to be Steph Jones.
Good morning, everybody, and again, welcome to our very exciting meeting. The talks this morning, or throughout the meeting, are going to be 45 minutes in length, so we'll have 35 minutes for the talk and hopefully 10 full minutes for questions. So our first speaker this morning, we're very pleased to have Beth Buffalo from the University of Washington, as of 2 days ago, I hear. And she's going to be talking about neural signals from memory and space in the primate medial temporal lobe.
So thank you, Nancy, and the other organizers and sponsors for inviting me. Again, this looks like an exciting couple of days, and I'm really honored to be here kicking it off. So the title is Neural Signals from Memory and Space in the Primate Medial Temporal Lobe. And the focus of the research in my lab is to really try to understand the neural mechanisms that might support memory, recording primarily from medial temporal lobe structures. And just to give you a sense of how we're approaching this problem, with my scientific background, I was really raised in the tradition of trying to understand memory by looking at cases of amnesic patients who suffered damage to medial temporal lobe structures and trying to understand their impairments in terms of telling us more about the role of these structures. But in parallel, for decades, there had been research going on in rodents, recording from these regions, the hippocampus and the surrounding cortical regions, and finding really elegant spatial representations that led to ideas about these structures being important for forming spatial and cognitive maps of our environment. And so in our work, we're going to be recording in monkeys in these same regions, in the hippocampus and medial temporal lobe structures, and trying to bridge these two ideas, trying to understand how these structures might contribute both to memory as well as to spatial representation. And so just to give you an outline of the data I'm going to present today, in the first part, I'm going to talk about rhythmic neuronal activity in the primate hippocampus and show you that this rhythmic activity is linked to eye movements and also that this activity is important for successful memory formation. And then in the second part, I'm going to talk more about spatial representations. So I'll tell you about some new data that we've been recording in the entorhinal cortex, again of awake monkeys, and showing that we get nice spatial representations in these regions, leading to the idea that visual exploration in primates might be analogous to exploration via movement in rodents. So first, just to give you a sense of the kind of memory that we're studying, we focused on a form of memory called recognition memory, which is just defined as the ability to perceive a recently presented or encountered item as familiar. And one of the simplest tests of recognition memory is called the preferential looking or paired comparison test. And this has been around for decades, used in primates, in non-human primates, as well as humans, even infants, as well as rodents in terms of the novel object task. In this kind of task in primates, they're shown two identical images for a period of time, and then after a delay, they're shown another set of images. And you may have noticed that when I presented this slide, your eyes are sort of drawn to the right side, to the new image in this picture. And what that indicates, what that sort of takes advantage of, is our innate preference for novelty. So all primates have an innate preference for novelty, and if they've seen something before and they remember it, then they're going to spend more time looking at the new image. And this is the form of recognition memory that we've been studying. And it's been shown throughout many species. Here I'm showing data from humans, monkeys, rats, and mice, that performance on this kind of task depends critically on structures in the medial temporal lobe, including restricted, so damage to just the hippocampus itself also produces impairment on this task. That's specific to longer delays when we know there's a tax on memory. So our version of the task is shown here. So we wanted to record from neurons in the hippocampus while monkeys were performing this task. So here we asked them to fixate a central cross for 1 second, and then we show a large complex image. And at this point, the monkeys are free to move their eyes to explore the image. And the monkeys control how long the picture is on the screen. So it stays on the screen as long as they continue to look at it, up to a maximum of 5 seconds. As soon as they look away, the image disappears, and then we go on to the next trial. And in each recording session, we show the monkeys 200 of these novel images, and each image is presented twice. And so what we can do, since the monkeys are controlling how long they're looking at the pictures, we can just compare the amount of time they spend looking at the images when they're repeated compared to when they're novel. And this gives us an index of how well they remember the pictures. And so what we find across many monkeys and hundreds of sessions of looking at these pictures is that monkeys spend less time looking at the images when they're repeated compared to when they're novel. And over here on the left is just showing an example scan pattern from one of our monkeys. In yellow is his scan pattern when he first encountered this picture. And you can see that he looked at quite a few of the features on the scene. And then the blue shows the scan pattern the second time he saw the picture, where he just explored a few of the features and then looked away. So this is our index for recognition memory. And what's also useful about this task is that there's not a right answer. So the monkeys are not rewarded for doing anything. They're just performing this kind of natural exploration. And we get variability in performance. So if we look here across two separate monkeys, showing their performance as a percent change in looking time, what we find is that there are some pictures that they show strong memory, so they show a really large percent change in looking time, and in other pictures that they don't remember as well. And so we can use this variability to try to understand how neural signals that support memory might contribute to this kind of performance. This is just to give you a sense of our recording setup. So the monkeys are seated in front of a computer monitor on which we display the visual images. And we're recording in the hippocampus using a single guide tube that contains 4 independently movable electrodes. And from each electrode, we're recording both the extracellular spikes and the local field potentials. And the one signal that we were really interested in looking at is the theta band oscillation. So this is something that's ubiquitous in rodent hippocampal recordings. It's really, if you talk to any rodent neurophysiologist who studies the hippocampus, this is the signal that lets them know that they've actually hit the hippocampus, because they just hear it whenever the rat is moving around exploring their environment. But in the monkey, it's been sort of an issue of debate whether or not primates really have the same kind of theta oscillation. And one of the suggestions has been that because we know this signal is so much more prominent when the rats are moving around exploring their environment compared to when they're sitting still, is that in most of the monkey experiments, the monkeys are sitting still, just like they are in our experiment, and maybe that's dampened our ability or prohibited us from being able to observe theta band oscillations. So in our experiments, since we had the monkeys sitting still, but we had them able to freely move their eyes and explore the images, we thought maybe we had a chance at finding theta band activity. And so this is just to show you some example raw traces, as well as power spectra from some of our hippocampal recordings. So indeed, we found evidence for theta band activity while they were performing this task, but it was not continuous in the same way that it was in rodents. It occurred in bouts. And here I'm just showing you a few of the bouts of theta that we observed. The theta band oscillation was at a sort of high theta, really with an average around 8 or 9 hertz. We did find a lower theta that was present in some of the trials that was closer to around 3 or 4 hertz. But for this talk today, I'm going to focus on the 8 to 9 hertz oscillation. So now back to exactly what the monkeys were doing. When they were performing this task, they were again moving their eyes around, exploring the images. And we started looking at the sort of pattern of the eye movements. And what it turned out is that these eye movements are actually fairly rhythmic. So this is just showing the fixation duration across many sessions with our monkeys. And we find that on average, they move their eyes at about 4 hertz with a peak at about, about 4 or 5 hertz with a peak at about 200 milliseconds for the fixation duration. And this is actually similar to the way humans move their eyes when they're exploring scenes. They also show this kind of 4 to 5 hertz rhythm. And it's also interesting that even if we're unable to have eye movements, in the case of a patient who had a developmental disorder that prevented her from being able to move her eyes, she developed a saccadic head movement pattern that actually allowed her to have normal visual perception and read normally. And when they measured the saccadic head movement, it had the same kind of pattern as rhythmic eye movements, with a peak, again, right around 200 milliseconds. Not to get too evangelical about theta, but I think it's just interesting to see it, throughout different fields and different species, that it sort of comes up again and again as a good rhythm for kind of parsing incoming information. So what we looked at for our data was the information or the theta activity right around each saccade. And what we noticed is that if we looked at individual trials and looked at the phase of theta, it was unlikely to be aligned prior to each saccade. But after the saccade, there appeared to be a phase resetting, so that now the phase of theta was more likely to be aligned across the different fixations. What we found was that this was not an evoked change in theta, so there was no increase in the power of theta when averaged across single trials. But if we do a trial average of the LFP, so we average across all of these individual fixations, what we find is that there is a significant increase in theta power. And so what this just reflects is that, again, this theta phase resetting that occurs on each saccade. And then we asked whether this theta phase resetting mattered in terms of memory formation, whether it contributed to the performance. So again, we took advantage of the variability in performance, and we compared trials that the monkeys remembered very well, these high recognition trials, compared to those that they didn't remember very well, the low recognition trials. And we just looked at the reliability of the theta phase reset for those two different conditions. And here's what we found. So we found that for the high recognition trials, right after the saccade onset, there was a significant increase in theta phase reliability. So you can see that there's strong phase reset even for the low recognition trials, but it's just more reliable for those trials that the monkey will later remember well. We also looked at theta power prior to stimulus onset, with the idea being that maybe theta just reflects a state of higher attentional attentional capacity or just a higher attentional state. And what we found was that there was greater theta band power prior to stimulus onset, which is shown here, for the high recognition trials compared to the low recognition trials. And this is just showing the subtraction between them. And we also looked in a previous publication at spike field coherence. So what I've been showing you now has just been talking about the power of the LFP. But now what I'm going to show you are some data looking at the relationship of the timing of spikes to fluctuations in the LFP. So this is a cartoon example of low coherence. This would be a representation of high coherence, where the spikes are occurring at the same phase of the LFP on each cycle. And here's what we found in terms of gamma band spike field phase synchronization. So for the high recognition trials, there was an increase in gamma band coherence compared to the low recognition trials. And across the population, we found that there was about a 10% increase in this gamma band synchrony for high recognition trials versus low recognition trials. And this was strikingly similar to what had been reported previously in human epileptic patients, where they found about a 10% increase in gamma band synchrony for subsequently recalled words compared to unrecalled words. So together, the data from this first section suggests that there's rhythmic neuronal activity in the primate hippocampus, and that it's linked to successful memory formation. And it's also linked to eye movement, such that we see a phase resetting, particularly of the theta band oscillation on each new saccade. And now I'm going to talk about spatial representations, focusing on our recordings in the entorhinal cortex. So for these recordings, we used a laminar electrode array. So this has an array of 12 contacts sort of linearly arranged, so we can record across the span of the entorhinal cortex. This is showing that this is the location of one of our recordings, so just medial to the rhinal sulcus in more of the posterior part of the entorhinal cortex. And just to remind you, what had been presented previously in rodents are these really elegant spatial representations. In the hippocampus, in 1971, it was discovered that there are place cells, so neurons that fire whenever the rat is in a given position in the environment. And then more recently, grid cells, these are cells in the entorhinal cortex that also have place fields, but they have multiple place fields, so they fire whenever the rat is in multiple positions in the environment. And the interesting thing about grid cells is that they have this really elegant geometric relationship, so that if you take each of these firing fields and draw a line between them, you see that they form the nodes of an equilateral triangle. And they really sort of tile the environment. And in the autocorrelation, you can see beautiful hexagons that come out of these equilateral triangles. So we wanted to see whether, again, our monkeys are not moving around in space, but they're moving their eyes around. And so we just wondered whether there were any spatial representations that reflected where the monkeys were fixating on the computer screen. Just before I present that, I also want to just point out there's another spatial representation that's been published in the rat entorhinal cortex, and these are border cells. So these are cells that respond whenever the rat is moving around the edge of the environment. So here's what we found in the primate in terms of grid cells. This is an example grid cell. Over here on the left, in gray, what you see is the monkey's scan pattern. And this is collapsed or averaged across all of the 200 images that he sees in a given day. And then in red, we've just put the spikes. And so these are spikes that occur whenever the monkey is looking at this position on the computer monitor. This is a firing rate map. And then here's the autocorrelation. And in order to determine whether these were really grid cells, we performed the same analysis that they used for the rodent grid cells. And this is just measuring the amount of 60-degree rotational symmetry in the autocorrelation. So we're comparing the correlation when we rotate this autocorrelation at 60 degrees and 120 degrees compared to the other orientations. And we found that there was a significant proportion of our neurons recorded in the entorhinal cortex that would meet this classification to be considered significant grid cells. And we also looked for another feature of rodent grid cells, which is that the size of the spacing between the fields expands as you move through the entorhinal cortex. So in rats, this is moving from dorsal to ventral through the entorhinal cortex. You see an expansion of the field spacing. And the comparable orientation in primates would be moving away from the rhinal sulcus. So here's an example grid cell that is very lateral, just close to the rhinal sulcus, where we get a very tight spacing. And then as we move farther away, farther medial, we can see that the fields expand. And this is just to show you the correlation across all of our recorded grid cells. We found this nice relationship again with distance from the rhinal sulcus and spacing between the fields. We also found some evidence for primate border cells. So here's a particularly strong example. So this is a neuron that only fired whenever the monkey was looking at this side of the screen. But we found a significant proportion of our cells also showed these kind of responses. And then more recently, we started looking at what might be comparable to head direction cells. So these are cells that have also been reported in the rat subiculum as well as the entorhinal cortex. These are neurons that fire in a selective way whenever the rat is moving with his head in a certain direction. So we thought the analogous thing in primates, at least in our experiment, might be saccade direction cells. So here we just looked at the activity just prior to and just after each saccade, and we did find a significant proportion of cells that showed a kind of selective firing for the saccade direction. And what was interesting is that it appeared to be most selective for the upcoming saccade instead of the prior saccade. So if we look at these saccade direction cells, these are the ones that showed a significant correlation for pre-saccade activity compared to post-saccade. So it appears that these neurons are sort of signaling the location of the upcoming saccade. And then we also looked at theta oscillations in our grid cells. So one prominent model of how these grid cells get generated has been the oscillatory interference model. And the idea has been that there are two different theta oscillations that interfere and then give rise to these grid fields. And there's been some intracellular evidence in support of this, showing that as you move through this dorsal to ventral axis, where you see the increase in the field spacing, they also found a gradient of the intrinsic membrane potential that would fit well with this sort of change in the frequency of the theta oscillation. However, there are other studies that suggest that maybe theta band activity is not necessary for the generation of these grid cells. So this was a study in bats looking at the grid fields during when the bats were in a theta bout compared to when they were not in a theta bout. One thing that was a little tricky for this experiment, I switched it around. This is without the theta bout. This is in the theta bout. And one thing that was a little difficult for this experiment is they didn't have a lot of data when the bats were actually in a theta bout. And there was another study published in rats showing that the theta oscillation was critical for these grid cells. So here they injected muscimol into the medial septum and found that it significantly disrupted the grid pattern. So in our data in the entorhinal cortex, we also find evidence for theta, similar to what we found in the hippocampus. It's not continuous, but it occurs in bouts. And here's just showing some examples of our theta bouts. And so we could, just like the bat study, we could compare the grid cells or the grid responses during the bouts, the theta bouts, and the non-bouts. And what we found is that, you know, when you split the data, everything looks a little messier. But we were still able to find evidence of these grid representations both in and out of a theta bout. So at least in our data, it suggests that theta oscillations are not necessary for the representation of the grid fields. We also, because the monkeys were performing a memory task, we also looked at memory responses in these same data. And what we found was that on average, across all of the entorhinal neurons that we recorded, there was a significant memory response, such that these neurons showed a match suppression. So they showed a decrease in firing rate for the repeated images compared to the novel images. But what was interesting was that there was an anatomical gradient of this response. So if we think about our recordings that were more posterior entorhinal cortex compared to the more anterior regions, what we found was that this response, this match suppression, grew as we moved to the more anterior locations. And correspondingly, we found that most of our grid cells were all in the posterior part of the entorhinal cortex. So it seems like the posterior corresponded more to the spatial representation and the anterior more to the mnemonic representation. And this fits kind of nicely with what we know in terms of comparing the rodent brain to the primate brain. So through evolution, the idea has been that the rodent brain, at least for these medial temporal lobe structures, has been kind of rotated. And if we think about the way the pathways are laid out in the rodent, where non-spatial information goes through the lateral entorhinal cortex and into the hippocampus, whereas spatial information goes through the medial entorhinal cortex. For primates, the comparable thing would be the posterior entorhinal cortex, which is exactly where we found the grid cells. And then the lateral would correspond to the anterior entorhinal cortex, where we found the stronger memory responses. So just to conclude from this part, these data suggest that hippocampal theta band activity is modulated by eye movements during visual exploration, and it reflects subsequent memory performance. The idea is that every time we move our eyes, there's a theta phase reset, and the reliability of that theta phase reset seems to be critical in terms of how well we're going to process the information in each fixation. We also found that successful encoding was associated with greater spike field synchronization in the gamma frequency band. And then finally, we found that primate entorhinal neurons demonstrate grid-like firing fields as monkeys fixate different regions in visual space. And we found spatial representations including grid cells, border cells, as well as saccade direction cells. And so together, I think these ideas or these data suggest that visual exploration in primates, again, may be analogous to exploration via movement in rodents. So I think it sort of opens up a new way to kind of look at recordings in primates and try to then see if we can compare or learn more about how they might relate to what's been described previously in rodents. Just to give you a little taste of some new data and kind of a direction where we're going in the lab, I have a student who's visiting in the lab who wanted to know whether these grid representations actually required eye movements, or instead maybe they reflected the locus of attention, which were not separable in our previous study. And so he trained a monkey to fixate a central cross and then covertly monitor a moving dot that he moves in a trajectory around the screen. And we know that the monkey's paying attention to this because we ask him to perform a task where he releases the bar that he's holding whenever that stimulus changes color. And so the hypothesis was that if he's fixating here, he's not moving his eyes, but his attention is being drawn to different regions of the screen. If these grid cells reflected the locus of attention, then we would find evidence for these kind of grid patterns. And these, again, are preliminary data, but I think we're encouraged by how sort of clear these autocorrelations are. Again, the monkey is not moving his eyes, but he's just covertly attending to this dot that's moving around in space. And we're marking here where the neurons fire in relation to the location of that moving circle. And then I want to just tell you about one other new experiment that we have ongoing in the lab. The idea is that if these spatial representations exist in the medial temporal lobe, then maybe we can find them not just when the monkeys are moving their eyes around, but if we could get them in some kind of virtual space. It's very hard to record from monkeys actually moving around in an environment, so we decided to start with a virtual environment. And I'll just show you a quick video of one of our monkeys here. So what you can see is the monkey was trained to kind of freely navigate this environment for bananas. And so this is an inset of his movements of the joystick. This is showing his trajectory in the environment. And the little circle shows his eye movement. So it's really exciting to be able to get, he's getting rewarded every time he hits a banana. That's what that little beep is. So it's really exciting for us now to be able to record not only his position in a space, but also his his focus of attention. You can see he zooms right in on the bananas. And then now we have complete control over the environment. So we can design all sorts of memory experiments. We can change the environment from trial to trial and see how these spatial representations map on to both 2D space in terms of his eye movements, as well as the 3D environment. And I just want to end by acknowledging all those who actually did the work. So this was just from a week or so ago. This is my student Nathan Killian in celebration of his dissertation defense. So Nathan did all the recordings, the original recordings in the entorhinal cortex. And then Mike Jutras did all of the recordings in the hippocampus. And Drew Solist and Kirill Stakov have been working on the new 3D navigation study. And Nicholas Vilming has been doing the covert attention study. So, and I want to thank also our funding sources. Thank you.
So we have plenty of time for questions.
Huh? How long does the phase reset last after the saccades?
It's a good question. So the question is, how long does the phase reset last? Saccades. It's a tricky question because we know it lasts at least as long as the fixation lasts. The problem is that the fixations are only on average about 200 milliseconds, and then they get reset again. So we spent some time looking at the reset for the fixation cross, so when the monkey fixates for 1 second on that cross. And for that, it's variable, but it can last up to 3 or 4 cycles for that one.
You said that the saccade frequency was 4 to 5 hertz, but the actual oscillation that it evoked was 8 to 10 hertz. Was there a doubling of the relationship? Was there anything systematic that you saw in comparing the two frequencies?
That's a good question. We didn't see that there, you know, it wasn't an exact doubling. But I have to say, we haven't looked at that carefully, so we could look at that some more. As I mentioned, we did see a lower frequency oscillation that did not appear to be, at least in our initial analyses, related to memory formation. But we're still trying to understand more about what that lower sort of 3 to 4 hertz oscillation might be related to.
So that was lower than the actual saccade
oscillation. A little bit lower, yeah.
And did you see anything similar with the covert attention in that that reset? When they didn't move their eyes, did you still see that?
That's a good question. So we haven't looked at that yet. So these are brand new studies. So we haven't looked at the phase reset for that. But that would be really interesting if there was a reset just for attention, attentional change.
Is there anything you can say about the way the theta band dies out? Is it abrupt? Is it parts? Is it exponentially dying? How would you say?
That's a good question. You know, my first response would be that it's just an abrupt. There's a change in the LFP, and it goes from a theta state to something that's less organized. But we haven't looked at that carefully. But that would be just from looking at the raw data. That's my impression.
Do you have a control when the monkey just fixates and doesn't move their eyes at all during the task? Sort of rule out whether it's at all dependent on eye movements or anything. I mean, the monkey just fixates during the task, and the exact same sequence of images just follows.
So we don't have that right now. What we're doing for the covert attention task, we're now recording in alternating blocks. The monkey is either covertly attending to that moving dot, or he's performing a delayed match to sample task at fixation. So there's going to be images that are presented right at fixation. And so we want to draw his attention away from the dot and see if we disrupt the grid pattern. That would be our prediction. But we're just starting those experiments.
Do you still see the theta bounce, the discrete theta bounce in the VR test? Or have you been looking at that yet?
You know, it's interesting. So we've just started these recordings, and we've positioned our electrodes a little more posterior in the hippocampus, again, based on this idea that with the rotation that happened through evolution, we expect that we might see more theta in what would correspond to the dorsal hippocampus in rats. So we're moving more posterior. And, you know, it's very exciting. Some of our initial, just looking at the recordings, in a way that we'd never seen before for the anterior recordings, you can just see theta in the raw signal, and it seems more continuous in these posterior recordings. But again, these are very early preliminary data. But we're encouraged that the theta is going to be different back there.
So you didn't observe something like saccadic probability being modulated by interface?
We did not. So the question was whether we observed saccadic probability being modulated by theta phase. No, we didn't look at that.
Same question for that lower frequency that you noted. Is there any chance that the probability is coupled to phase of that lower frequency?
It certainly could be, but we just haven't looked at that. Yeah, that's a good suggestion.
Other questions? I had one more question. When you did the spike field coherence with the gamma, did you ever do spike field with lower frequencies? Did you only see it in gamma, or?
No, I mean, we did look. We did see it in theta, similar to what had been reported in humans. There was a paper by Uli Rudeshauser showing that there was spike field coherence in theta in the human hippocampus that predicted subsequent recognition memory. We did find it's harder, you know, when you have these lower frequencies, your resolution is not as great. And we also have, these neurons have very low firing rate. So
what
you're
is
dealing.
The firing rate of the neurons?
For the principal neurons, the baseline is around 1.5 hertz. So they're pretty low. So it makes it more difficult to see that. But.
And how about any effects of learning? Did you look as the monkey was trained? Any effects of learning? Did you look as the monkey was training if any of this stuff became more robust as it got better at the task?
So for this experiment, we didn't. So this is a task that actually doesn't require any training. So if you remember, they're not getting rewarded. They're just looking at pictures. But we do have some other tasks that we're developing that will have a learning aspect. And certainly with the virtual navigation, we have some new experiments planned where we'll actually record while they're learning new spatial locations for targets and things like that.
I have two questions, if I may. The first one, you talked about memory formation, but what about memory access? I mean, you didn't spend much time into the theta behavior when the second time. And the second question, can you speculate on what would happen with speech that is rhythmic in that range?
Yeah, so I'll start with the second question. I don't want to be too evangelical about theta, but it is interesting that across different modalities, and maybe Charlie will talk about this a little more tomorrow, but across different modalities, you do see this theta rhythm present, as you said, in speech. In rats, they sniff and whisk at theta. There's a new paper that I saw in Journal of Neuroscience just last week, I think, from Adam Kepik, showing the importance of this theta phase sniffing and whisking, particularly during novel exploration. So it's a good reason to be evangelical about theta. Yeah, maybe I should just sort of admit it and come out as being evangelical about theta. But you see it in so many different modalities, so I think it's important to pay attention to it, definitely. And then your first question. About memory access, yes. So we haven't done it yet, but we have all these, all these trials now, where we could look at what's happening during the second presentation. And I have a student who's here, Seth, who's actually looking at modeling the eye movement behavior during novel and in repeat presentations, and then he's going to be recording in the hippocampus and looking at exactly that.
Any other questions?